I'm Bill Huckberg, and on this episode of the Music Lawbeat, I'll talk with Peter Anderson and Aaron Moss. And they are A-list entertainment litigators who understand music copyright law upside, downside, backwards, forwards, better than most. Aaron is at Mitchell, Silverberg & Knopf. He's a terrific litigator. He posts this excellent blog called Copyright Lately. Check it out. Peter Anderson at Davis Wright Tremaine has handled several famous and game-changing music copyright cases for chart-topping artists and major music companies. Now, one of them is the Stairway to Heaven case, where he successfully defended Led Zeppelin's Jimmy Page, Robert Plant, and Warner Chappell Music against a lawsuit by the owners of the song Taurus by the band Spirit. You know the song Taurus by Spirit, right? No? Do you know Stairway to Heaven? It's amazing how many younger and older people don't know legacy songs that we assume are etched into the public consciousness forever. That was on another episode. We talked about that with Laurent Hubert of Cobalt, the CEO of Cobalt Music, and Jeff Biederman. But it turns out that nothing's permanent. So some people don't know what Stairway to Heaven sounds like. So how about if I just go ahead and play? I'll play Stairway to Heaven. Oh, wait, there's a sign that says no Stairway to Heaven. It's from Wayne's World. We are not above the law here. Wayne's World, 1992 film with Mike Myers and Dana Carvey. No Stairway to Heaven can be played in a music store. We're gonna abide by that here. And it goes back to the time of Bach, many say, and so it's a common progression. So we'll talk about chord progressions and rhythms and how those play out in these copyright litigation cases involving Ed Sheeran, Dua Lipa, Katy Perry, and others. And we'll talk about other very interesting issues involving music copyright, like involving statutes of limitation and termination statute and how they play out. So whether we actually need music copyright law at all is a topic that we'll get into. Delete copyright law. In Bach's time, there wasn't any copyright law. And Jack Dorsey and Elon Musk would probably point that out as they say, just delete it. But these are debatable and we will debate it. These and other fascinating music copyright topics are coming at you right now. So let's get jamming. I'm really excited to have two really great copyright experts and litigators, Peter Anderson from Davis Wright Tremaine and Aaron Moss from Mitchell, Silverberg & Knopf. And so we're going to talk about copyright, you know, what's copyrightable, what might not be, you know, AI cases, fair use, statute of limitations. We got a lot to cover. We may not get to all of it, but we're going to try. So we're going to start out with an issue here about chord progressions and rhythms. You know, are they copyrightable? And the Ed Sheeran case, which we have a decision recently regarding Thinking Out Loud, that case, and whether a simple kind of a chord progression is, you know, something you can get sued over. So I'm going to actually start this off with a clip from the Howard Stern show, where Ed is actually, well, let's just start it off. Genna, can you hit it, please?
I want to congratulate you on this court case. There is nothing worse in my book as somebody who creates stuff, somebody accusing you of a ripoff. I read in the paper, you sat down with the jury, and I think this is great, and you took out your guitar, and you said to the jury, you think I ripped off this song? I'm going to play you something now and show you how similar things can be. What did you play for that jury? If I was the jury, yeah, what did you say to them?
So it was, so my one is, when your legs don't work like they used to before, and then there's, have I told you lately that I loved you? And then, people get ready, there's a train coming. And then, what was the, looks like we made it. Look how far we've come, my baby. And oh, she breaks just like a woman. I mean, there was 101 songs that, and that was like scratching the surface. There was like 101, you know, there's, I guess you'll say. It's really, and what I was saying is like, yes, it's a chord sequence that you hear on successful songs, but if you say that a song in 1973 owns this, then what about all the songs that came before? We found songs like from like the 1700s that had similar melodic stuff, and then there was like huge songs in the 50s and huge songs in the 60s, and it's just, no one's saying that songs shouldn't be copyrighted, but you just can't copyright a chord sequence.
I'm gonna just take him to task there. I think it's great, you know, and this was, he was upheld on appeal, but this, you can, if it's a complicated chord sequence. So you can't just, some musicians have the misapprehension, I think, that chord progressions can't be copyrighted, but ho-hum kind of humdrum 1-4-5 kind of progressions can. I'm actually gonna also just say that, you know, he says there's 101 songs. One of them is People Get Ready, Curtis Mayfield, one of my favorite songs, and I represent the estate of Curtis Mayfield. I'm actually going to show you something here. And I want you guys to put your, I'm going to play a little guitar here and show you how there's a difference. And put yourselves on mute, because I don't want any booing from you guys if I really suck here. So please do that.
So is he about to sue Ed Sheeran for mislabeling the chords
in a
Curtis Mayfield song?
Not at all. No, the Mayfield estate does not, it's not the Marvin Gaye estate. Let's put it that way. But what he's saying that his song is, let's see. Sorry. That's the Sheeran one. And People Get Ready is, so you can hear the difference between, which is his, and which goes to the sixth chord. And no, I don't think we're we mind it, but I just think that I think that Ed Sheeran's probably not watching this podcast, but if he is, don't do that again. You have maybe 100, maybe there's 100, but not 101. Okay, there's one song that's not following that chord progression, and that's People Get Ready. But his point, and he's an amazing musician. He gets up in Wembley Stadium and plays, you know, himself with a looper and creates songs, kind of like what John Bryan does or did here around LA. the point that I want to bring to you guys is there's a misapprehension among musicians that chord progressions can't be copyrighted. I mean, what would you say to that? Is that true generally, or where do you draw the line? Anybody?
Well, I mean, what the cases say is that you can't claim protection in a basic chord progression alone. I mean, I suppose that if you had a really complex chord progression, earlier Bill mentioned one of the Queen songs, and my response to that was, yes, it was so unusual that the record company didn't want to release it. You know,
and that's Bohemian Rhapsody, yeah. By the way, yeah.
Yeah, and the interesting thing to me about the Ed Sheeran case, I mean, clearly, you can't protect. There are basic chord progressions that are repeated over and over and over again. They're basic musical building blocks, and you can't protect them alone. And the argument was really that it was a selection and arrangement claim, because it was also similar in harmonic rhythm, how the chords are spaced over time. And the interesting thing was the district court initially in the one case that went to trial found that there's no numerosity requirement under Second Circuit law for a selection and arrangement. So if you have two admittedly public domain unprotectable elements, a basic chord progression and a basic harmonic rhythm, you know, maybe that's protectable. And there was actually two cases. The other one was brought by structured assets.
Structured music assets.
Right. And that's the one that got to the Second Circuit. And the Second Circuit said, no, you can't claim copyright by just combining a, you know, public domain chord progression and a public domain harmonic rhythm. I mean, it was so minimal. You know, in the Ninth Circuit, we have a numerosity requirement, and cases in the non-music context have rejected 7-8 similarities of unprotected material as being insufficient for a selection and arrangement claim. So it's just really interesting to me to see a whole trial over two, both sides admitted these are the only similarities, the basic chord progression and harmonic rhythm, and that's supposed to be a protectable selection and arrangement. It just seemed dead on arrival.
Yeah, I mean, I think though that the summary judgment in the SAS case was, I think, in essence, a mea culpa to the fact
Yes.
that the judge allowed the Townsend case to go forward. I think that probably if the judge had a do-over, he would have come out a different way. And I agree with you, Peter. I think that the idea of having two elements to make a selection and arrangement is a little bit foreign, at least here in the Ninth Circuit, where we talk about, they need to be numerous enough and original enough to be protectable. But I think at the same time, the court was very clear that if those two elements are commonplace. I think that the way that the court characterized what the test would be is how many available options are there? What are the, in the court's words, external factors that would limit the viability of those options? And then you have the prior uses. So I think that by framing it in that way, hopefully will disincentivize somebody from trying to bring a lawsuit based on two elements if, like in Sheeran, where it's the syncopated anticipation technique combined with the common chord progression, both of those being very commonplace, should be DOA.
So now, how does the Blurred Lines case play into this? Blurred Lines case a few years ago, really nothing was the same, okay? But somehow the jury came up to the idea that this was, there were hi-hat cymbals in both of them, there was crowd noise, there was a vibe, and it kind of created a storm of these kind of cases, which I might say were many frivolous ones. Whereas, thank you, Peter Anderson, for winning the Stairway to Heaven case for the Page and Plant and Warner Chappell Music, which really kind of closed the door on a lot of these frivolous cases, but yet you still are having them come up. How do you guys, where is it going here? Are we moving in the right direction here? Do you guys think, in terms of copyright infringement cases involving, as you say, very commonplace building blocks of music?
I'll go. First of all, thank the Ninth Circuit sitting down bank. I mean, I think Skidmore, to the Ninth Circuit's credit, was a watershed event. I mean, we had amicus briefs from, I think, 127 songwriters who said, if you allow things like blurred lines, then we can't even use descending chromatic scales. I mean, basic building blocks. And I think it has had its effect. And we see summary judgment motions granted in the music area repeatedly citing Skidmore. SAS, the Second Circuit decision, cites Skidmore. The Gray versus Hudson, in reversing a jury, affirming the reversal of a jury verdict where they clearly got it wrong, relies on Skidmore. And seeing the Second Circuit cite Skidmore, I think, is a good sign. You always have cases, and you always have the issue of a plaintiff who just thinks their work is remarkable, unique, and all that kind of stuff. But the court has more ability now. The courts in the Ninth Circuit, at least, have more ability to look through that on summary judgment and parse it out, keeping in mind that selection and arrangement claims are dangerous because they potentially infringe on the public domain. We're talking about unprotected elements. And sometimes, as Aaron mentioned, sometimes functionality, comes into it. There's only so many notes. There's seven natural notes. There's 12 if you include sharps and flats, and there's only so much you can put. And the kind of claims that I see, and I'd be interested in what Aaron sees, but are often, confined to one measure or two measures, and there's a limited number of ways of arranging 12
No.
notes and two measures.
Yeah, no, I. No, sorry.
No, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I agree, and I think the courts are starting to get that. There was a case just decided in the last month or so involving Dua Lipa, where the court out of the Southern District of New York threw that out on summary judgment because the only musical phrase that was shared was, a set of descending scales. So it was these five groupings of repeated 16th notes. It was a B minor scale in Levitating. It was a D major scale in a song called Don Diablo, which was not particularly well known. There was an access issue as well, but the courts are getting it, and I think that even in the Second Circuit, where the law has not, at least historically, been as defined in terms of filtering. What we have now seen from the Sheeran case is essentially taking the Second Circuit test, this lay observer test, but latching onto it a filtering that is, I think, helpful for defendants going forward. Look, I see Blurred Lines as the outlier. Clearly, the pendulum has swung back the other way. The vibe theory, I think, has been discredited. The court in the Dua Lipa case talked about this, the fact that Levitating and Dom Diablo have both had a pop with a disco vibe. That's not something that you can protect. And I
No,
think that,
right. Yeah.
you're
I
going to
mean,
get away from that.
it's like it was da 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 da. You know, four sets of 16th notes. That's what all it was. You know, or the Katy Perry case, which the Dark Horse case was just sounded like a metronome, basically what it was. So it's like people were after Blurred Lines, it was sort of like a open season. You know, everybody was just going crazy with these ideas that anything that was on the top 10. If it has, a vibe or something. So I think, because the purpose of copyright law, maybe you could talk to that also, Aaron. Like, what is the purpose of copy? You've got like Elon Musk and saying like, we don't know, we don't need to have copyright anymore. But what is, isn't it to basically for society to have, not only the music industry, but to enrich society with a flow of ideas and music and all that sort of thing. And so how is that served by these cases that like Blurred Lines?
Well, look, I think first of all, music is tough. You both are musicians. I'm not. I love music, but music is complicated. And frankly, I think that there is the problem that we see is that if you listen as a lay observer in the Blurred Lines case, first of all, you're hearing a bunch of stuff that wasn't really at issue because it was, the case was defined by the deposit copy. We can, put that aside for a minute. But I think there would be a real benefit in these cases rather than having like a battle of the experts that are, each side comes armed with an expert that courts could bring in neutral experts. So this is provided for under Rule 706. And the idea would be that you have a neutral expert who could break it down and say, okay, look, here is what you actually should be focused on. And as a court, someone who is not well versed in music would, I think, benefit from that, both at the summary judgment stage and then if it got to a jury at the jury stage.
Yes. So,
If I, oh,
yeah,
sorry.
please.
If I had my druthers, the jurors would be musicians. I mean, because I think, they can sit back and they can say, well, that's tone color. That's just what a guitar sounds like, and that's not protected. And they can work through it. I think that it's always been interesting to me because I've been doing this for a long time and had a lot of these cases. I think I've had only one where the musicologists on each side disagreed as to the music. And it was one that was recent, and there was a disagreement as to the key because one of the songs was a little bit ambiguous in key. They generally agree, I mean, someone might argue, well, this has a grace note that's important or something like in hair songs, but generally they agree on the music. And we were talking before about Arnstein versus Porter, which is an old, Second Circuit case, and the majority. the two of the judges on the panel reversed the grant of summary judgment after listening to the recordings. And the dissent said, those are the recordings. Look at the sheet music. They're not the same. And ultimately, a jury, threw it out, a case against Cole Porter. So, I think an expert might be a good idea. And,
Yes. Well,
but
but
I haven't
Peter,
seen disagreement as to the sheet music.
so I agree with that, Peter, but don't you see lately, it seems to me that what I have seen in these cases is that the experts, while perhaps not disagreeing on the music, are going a step farther and are opining, or at least they're trying to get it in the back door as to whether, therefore, it's substantially similar or infringing, which really the expert analysis ought to stop with the analysis and not veer into the therefore. That's what I'm seeing when I at least read the cases.
Absolutely correct. I mean, there was a summary judgment grant to Mariah Carey a couple of weeks ago over All I Want for Christmas. There was a disagreement as to key, but not really as to the notes. But then the plaintiff's experts went beyond that and said, well, this is important, and there's case law that says the importance of public domain elements is irrelevant to a song. Is it public domain? Is it, arranged originally and all that? I'd also like to go back to what I understood Bill was asking was, what's the purpose of copyright? And it clearly is to encourage creativity, but the limits on copyright are as important as the rights themselves, because you have to limit the protection to allow other people to use the basic unprotected elements in the same or different ways, as long as they're not that exact same, particular design. And, we did have creativity before we had our first Copyright Act, the first Copyright Act in the world. I mean, Shakespeare, there was no Copyright Act.
Yeah, there was no
But
copyright.
right, but I still believe that copyright protection for literature, for books, for photos, and all that is a big incentive to being creative. Now, maybe some people, without any financial reward, would, create a really, really good song, but having the financial reward is got to be an incentive. So I wouldn't get rid of it.
Absolutely.
I think there can be a legitimate debate of where the balance lies, but the idea of no copyright law at all just doesn't recognize that we are where we are because of things like patent law and copyright law.
Well, you look, I don't think anybody really has taken Elon Musk and Jack Dorsey seriously. I can't believe that they would not recognize that the entire, arts, media, gaming, entertainment industries would absolutely collapse in the face of that, including, by the way, their own companies that rely on IP all the time. So to me, I think to paraphrase Logan Roy, these are not serious people. I think it was meant to be provocative more than anything here.
Yeah. Well,
If
let's
memory
talk.
serves, didn't
No.
Elon allow all of the initial Tesla software, whatever? Didn't he open source that and encourage other people to make electric cars? That was so long ago. I
That's
may have that
interesting. Yeah,
wrong,
I don't. We
but I
could
don't
do a
think he
whole other
claimed
one on that.
copyright in the original,
Yeah, but.
Your work deserves more than attention. It deserves protection. Reins is trusted by artists, producers, and creatives across the industry. With offices in Los Angeles, New York, Chicago, and beyond, we bring sharp legal thinking to litigation, business, real estate, and private client matters, protecting tomorrow and delivering today. We've got you. Reins.
I want to get to like back to summary judgment. The two sweetest words for a defendant who thinks they have a strong case is, and why judges have been. You mentioned Arnstein v. Porter. That was Cole Porter and some guy, crazy guy, if I may say so, who was just a serial. He just kept suing and suing and suing, and it was frivolous. And the judge knew it, and the judge. Didn't want to grant a summary judgment one because it was a fact issue, went up on appeal. The appeals court sent or no, the judge did grant summary judgment, went on appeal. The appeals court said, well, it's a fact issue, went back down to the jury, and the jury agreed with the district court judge. So judges are reluctant. And if we go to reluctant to grant summary judgment, and you can maybe talk about that, and maybe that's changing, but this new recent case, Thomson Reuters v. Ross Intelligence, not a music case, but it may have some impact. It's a fair use case involving AI, and where you had a judge who was facing something that was a no-brainer, if you ask me. I mean, it was like Westlaw head notes, a competing company takes those, asks for permission to use those notes. Westlaw says, no, you can't. And then they hire a third party to come up with something similar. The third party just takes those notes and head notes and uses them. Copyright infringement, but then Ross says, no, not copyright infringement, it's just fair use, because those opinions are public domain, judicial opinions can't have a copyright. So they tried that and didn't work. So, but you had Judge Bibas on summary judgment the first time in a 2023 opinion. He said, well, no, that's, I can't grant a summary judgment. And then he had sort of like a prologue at the top of his opinion, which was facts can be messy, even when parties wish they were not. But summary judgment is proper only if factual messes have been tidied. Courts cannot clean them up. And then a year later in 2024, he changed his mind and he issues a revised ruling and says, well, basically he agreed with the plaintiff, Thomson Reuters, that it was summary judgment, and he as a judge could stop it, because that's what summary judgment does, right? It stops right dead in its tracks a case, or it can. And so he says he has a little prologue to his next opinion, which is, quote, a smart man knows when he is right, a wise man knows when he is wrong. Wisdom does not always find me, so I try to embrace it when it does, even if it comes late, as it did here, end of quote. And I love that. I think that's amazing. What do you guys think about a judge? And he uses the first person a lot in his opinion. Do you find that to be amazing, that he did that? And what we can get into a discussion about is, should judges be, ruling on music cases like these ones we're talking about on summary judgment? But first, like, what about Bibas just making a complete reversal? I mean, how do you feel about that in his own opinion?
My two cents, we should have like a quiz show buzzer so to know who goes first. First off, Arnstein versus Porter, that was under an old summary judgment standard that you had to deny it if there was the slightest doubt. So I found judges receptive to summary judgment motions in music cases. You know, it doesn't always work, but they're receptive to it because of the way the Ninth Circuit law has come around. As far as the case you're talking about, I think it's wonderful. I think for a judge to have the guts to say a year later, you know what, I got that wrong. And to do it so eloquently, I mean, I love that language. I love that initial language in the second opinion. And I think kudos to the judge.
So yeah, I mean, that said, there's obviously a lot to unpack with that ruling and, the implications certainly for the 40 plus other AI cases that are pending. But I don't think it's quite as simple as to say, well, they copied the head notes. I mean, certainly there was intermediate stage copying. The real question is, what is the purpose of that intermediate stage copying? Because if it's to use it to learn language patterns, to extract factual materials, remember, I mean, these are not, contrary to the way that the judge characterized them, these are not the most creative things in the world. These are distillations of public domain judicial opinions. But the issue really is, and it's a very complicated, tough issue that courts are going to be grappling with. What is the purpose of that intermediate stage copying, that training data stage copying? Is it to extract factual information? Is it to learn patterns? Is it to understand relationships? Or is it to, replicate the creative aspects of the material, the expressive, protectable aspects, en route to producing a work that is going to be competing with the original. And that's ultimately what you look at in these intermediate stage copying cases, is to decide whether it's fair use, what's the ultimate purpose to which it's being made. And that is something that I think that the court, in kind of brushing off the idea that intermediate copying is limited to computer code cases, which it's really not. The real question is, what is the purpose of that copying?
I agree with everything Aaron's saying. I think there's also, and it's consistent, I think, with what he's saying, is that it's different than the AI cases that we're seeing, in at least a couple of respects. The underlying material was all factual. We're not talking about someone feeding songs to a computer to generate something. And it also was not generative AI. It was just a search engine,
right?
You know, and so, you know, does it make a difference if it's a creative work? It does. It's copied in the process. And does it make a difference if you're adding, you know, new stuff to it, new content? You know, those are things that I think are supposed to be considered. I mean, my own personal view, for whatever it's worth, is that, you know, feeding music into a program to generate new music is a problem that competes with the original music. But, yeah, you know, people can talk about that, but, and there are cases out there pending. This case in particular, though, is different.
No, and I completely agree with that, Peter. And I think that it's in some respects unfortunate that this case happened to get a 2-year head start, because what ended up happening is that, you know, and frankly, when summary judgment was denied the first time around, I think at that point there were maybe only a handful of these other lawsuits, and the scope of the problem was not quite as well understood or recognized. And so by virtue of the fact that you had this non-generative tool, that's a big distinction. The second big distinction, as you point out, is that it is dealing in you know, the copying of what is in essence facts, and not particularly creative expression. You run the risk, just by virtue of the fact that this case has that 2-year head start, of having that impact all the cases that are now pending, the 40 plus cases, in which you have, number one, much more creative works being ingested, and number two, you have a generative AI, and number three, you have tools that arguably are competing with the original. So it's a different situation. I think that what we've seen so far is that the courts that are looking at the generative cases have distinguished the Bibas decision, at least in the couple that I'm aware of. They've kind of said, look, you know, that's not really persuasive because it's not dealing with generative AI. It's not really the issues that are on the table here. And I think that so long as courts recognize that, not to say that their jobs are going to be easy in these.
About like generative AI here, but and the word ingested, which you brought up and is used a lot, and the idea that, okay, if I have a computer, okay, and I want to listen to a song that sounds like Lou Reed or something like that, like a life-changing song, hopefully, whatever, or I want it to sound like a cross between Mozart and Paul McCartney or something like that, and I just want to hear it for myself, okay, and it's ingested, all of that music has been ingested by the AI machine, but I'm not going to put it out there. I just want to hear it for my own enjoyment, okay? Why is that? I don't know why that's actionable. And I want to just, if I could mention this case, this music case, Chapman v. Minaj, which I think is, I can tie into this. That's a case where a judge ruled that Tracy Chapman's song had been on summary judgment, that Minaj had copied Chapman's song, no question about it. She, you know, just flatly wholesale used her song. But it was a demo, okay? It was never distributed. Or that was going to be the next step. That was going to be the next step, but they settled the case. Was it ever distributed? Because it was just if it was just copying, you know, and just maybe for an internal purposes or whatever. And that's sort of like with these AI cases, which if I'm just listening, if an AI engine is just taking data sets, scraping the internet so that I can, for my own pleasure, listen to the music, or if I'm Minaj and I'm just making a demo and not putting it out to the public, why should that be actionable?
Well, I think there's a big difference. So in the case of Nicki Minaj, she created this interpolation specifically based on at least the record in that case in order to determine whether she could get permission from Chapman. Okay. And that is done routinely where oftentimes, if you're going to try to get a license, the party in the position to say yay or nay is going to want to hear the use. And so obviously, you're going to have to create something, an intermediate copy in this case, for the purpose of determining whether you can get a license. And so in that situation, this goes to the point I was making a few minutes ago, which is that intermediate copying is a fair use because it was for the purpose of determining whether you can get a license or not. Now, there was an issue because the song later was leaked. That's another mm-hmm. story. But in the case of these AI tools, the copying, the intermediate stage ingestion, you know, training data stage copying is not for the purpose of determining whether you're going to get a license or not. It is to train the tool. Now, that may be fair use for other reasons. It may not be. That's the open question. But I think that the point that I think is really important to understand is that you can't just look at it in a vacuum. You have to say, what is the purpose to which those intermediate copies will ultimately be used in order to determine whether it's fair use or not?
Peter, right. What do you think? He's right. I mean, it wasn't used as a demo, but it was used only in the Chapman case. It was used only to send to try and get a license. So this is what it will sound like. And it just happened to be leaked by someone else. You know, that leaking, that was what created the potential liability. It wasn't the creation of the initial recording to try and get a license. You know, and you're hypothetical about someone who wants to just merge a couple of things to, you know, see what it sounds like. I mean, you know, it's almost like, you know, the old, was it Nimmer, you know, if you sing a song in the shower, it's not an infringement. You know, it's sort of like, you know, maybe it's de minimis, maybe it's the purpose, you know, maybe it's just, you've got the two copies, you own the copies. If they're books, can you like chop them up and, you know, put them together as long as you're not selling them, you know? So I think that's probably at least my answer to that.
So it's okay, not copyright infringement, just to, so if these AI companies are ingesting all of this stuff off of the internet, but it's not actually being used commercially or it's not being distributed in any way, that's not actionable. It's just,
It's sort of like, you know, buying a couple of cassettes when back in the day when we had cassettes, or even I had a reel to reel when I was a kid, and I'd splice together things, and I'd put a new compilation together, you know, just for me. I didn't sell it. I didn't give it to friends. You know, that to me is just, you know, it's not infringing, whether you want to call it a fair use or.
Right. But there's a difference. I mean, this goes to the issue of commerciality, because if you're doing it, you know, in your, you know, basement for the purpose of your own enjoyment, that's different than, Bill, in your situation when you're saying an AI company. I mean, it's to what end?
No, but the AI company is ingesting all of this stuff so that it's like the Sony v. Betamax, the Sony Betamax, like home use thing. It's a fair use, I guess, if I'm listening to something, but in Suno and Udio, I think those cases, they're actually being sued just for you know, dragging the internet and dragging up all of that.
Well, right, because it's a much more complicated issue than the issue of are you creating something in your basement for your own personal enjoyment? Because if you're scraping, you know, whether it's the open internet or whether it's shadow libraries, whatever it is, if you're making those copies for the purpose of releasing a tool commercially that competes with the originals. I mean, you know, in the Suno and Udio cases, like, you know, they've there was a lawsuit by one of the German
Gamma.
And
it's a PRO, German yeah. PRO, like
and they
DMR.
Showed that, I mean, like, you know, this thing is spitting out you know, stuff that you know, that sounds like you know, like a lot of their represented songs. So, you know, that's,
but what I'm saying is, if it's spitting it out, but it's only spitting it out in the comfort of your basement man cave, like where I'm in right now, and rather than just putting it out commercially, is why couldn't these AI companies just have a disclaimer and say, don't use this commercially, just for your own home use? Would they be actionable then for them to be using all of that stuff?
I mean, look, I think it's still a commercial use, and we can yeah. obviously we can debate whether that commercial use is nevertheless fair. I think these are all
I guess it would be a commercial use if you had to pay a subscription for that. Yes.
Well, but there's ad revenue. I mean, they're not doing it out of the, you know, goodness
right.
of their heart. You know, they're making money. It's a commercial purpose. And maybe I misunderstood your hypothetical, but I thought it was just, you know, I sit at home and I, you know, splice together a couple of different songs to see what they sound like, or use a computer to do that. And it never gets out. It doesn't compete with anyone. It you know, I'm not making money off of it.
So you're fine. It's just if a company that gives you don't have to splice tape anymore, Peter. Now you have this.
But they're doing it to the whole
wonderful
world.
Thing.
They're doing it to the whole world, and they're doing it to make money or recognition or you know whatever they're doing it for. So I agree with Aaron. I think the commerciality of it is a big factor that
okay.
cuts against large companies doing. Companies
amazing. Doing yeah. So we can, anything else on this one, or we can go to the statute of limitations stuff that I wanted to hit on, like Warner Chappell v. Neely, unless like Aaron or Peter, if you have anything else you want to say on this part.
No, not me.
Okay.
Nope.
Okay. So yeah, talk to me about Warner Chappell v. Neely, interesting case about, and the statute of limitations. And that's something that musicians and rights holders are very, very interested in knowing about. How does that darn statute of limitations work, and what's going on with it? Warner Chappell, would one of you sort of summarize Warner Chappell v. Neely, or do you want me to just go for it? Yeah.
Okay. Peter, you want to go ahead on this?
Sure. The Copyright Act says that a claim has to be brought within 3 years of when it accrues. And most circuits follow a discovery rule that it doesn't accrue until the person, the plaintiff, knew or should have known that the claim existed. In getting rid of the latches defense, the Supreme Court also said things like, you have to sue within 3 years or that's it. And so it caused a lot of confusion is that, you know, was the Supreme Court and Peretti versus MGM getting rid of Petrella versus MGM, was it getting rid of the discovery rule or not? There was a footnote that just noted that, you know, some courts have followed a discovery rule. And
well, let me just put a footnote in there, like the discovery rule and the injury rule. Okay, discovery rule is basically saying that in many cases, it's when you found out about it. So if some infringement happened, like in this case in Neely, the guy was in prison, okay? So he can say, legitimately, they don't have internet in the prison, you know, available for me. I couldn't hear this infringement, so I should get time because I didn't discover it until my friend on the outside told me about it, or until I got out and found out about it. So that's the discovery rule. The injury rule is when it happened, regardless. If you're in prison, tough luck, you know, it's the injury rule. So back to you.
Yeah. I mean, it takes a little bit of chutzpah to say, I couldn't have found out about it because I committed a felony and ended up in prison. But setting that aside, so after Petrella, there was a lot of uncertainty as to whether the discovery rule actually survived the case. And in Shum, I think it was, in the Second Circuit, they came up with this idea of, okay, Petrella flatly says you can't sue after more than three years after. But we have a discovery rule. So the answer for the Second Circuit was, you can sue anytime, you know, within 3 years of when you found out or should have found out about it, but you can only get relief for 3 years, which makes
meaning you can only get damages going back 3 years.
Yes,
from
exactly.
when you filed.
So you can sue 10 years later if you found out about it, but you can't get damages for it, which kind of raises the question of why would you sue? But and the Ninth Circuit came out the other side and said, look, Petrella doesn't specifically say that it overrules or abrogates the discovery rule, so we follow the discovery rule. Then you have Warner Chappell versus Neely, and which was in a different circuit, and Warner Chappell did not challenge the discovery rule that was applied in that case, and then petitioned for review on the theory that it was going to challenge the discovery rule. And the court changed the question presented to avoid that issue because it had never been raised below at the circuit. Warner Chappell didn't challenge the discovery rule at that circuit. And if you've listened to the oral argument, it's really kind of interesting because they really gave Warner Chappell's lawyer a hard time of, you know, stop talking about that because we changed the order. Our question for you is, you know, and ultimately, you know, it ruled that the Second Circuit was wrong in its interpretation of Petrella and left untouched the discovery rule without ruling on it one way or the other, saved it for another case. And you had three justices who dissented and said, let's decide it now because there is little or no chance the discovery rule is going to survive. So you've got three judges who pretty clearly don't like the discovery rule. And you've got a pending petition for cert, which last I looked hadn't been acted on. They need four judges to grant cert. So the question, I think, in that case, the pending cert case, is a fourth judge, justice going to come forward and say, you know what? Yeah, let's review this.
So
and
this
so
means
far, I think the briefing's still going.
This means that it's use it or lose it, right? And in other words, if something is released, a recording is released more than three years ago and you didn't sue, you're done. If there's no discovery rule, basically. Yeah. Whereas now it's like, it's no, if you had a reason not to discover it, you can still do it. Go ahead.
Well, yeah, no, look, I think that's right. I mean, Neely will end up eventually being a footnote because the question will be whether there is a discovery rule or not. And interestingly, you know, as Peter notes, it's, you had three justices, you know, the ones that typically align with the conservative wing of the court, saying that the Copyright Act almost certainly does not tolerate a discovery rule. It is more than just those justices, though, that have held that way in the context of other statutes. There was a case from about 5 or 6 years ago involving the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, where eight members of the court, including Sotomayor and Kavanaugh and Roberts and Kagan, all found that there was no discovery rule that applies to those cases. There was a case when Ginsburg was on the court where she wrote a majority opinion finding that discovery rule didn't apply. So in the correct case, and whether we don't know yet whether this RA design case will be the one or not, but at some point the court is going to grapple with this issue of whether the discovery rule applies.
I mean, there's two issues too. One is, you know, you have to file within 3 years of when you discovered or when it happened. And the other issue is how far back can you go for damages? So like, let's assume that you did file within 3 years of when the injury happened. Let's take that example. How do these cases come out, or what's the debate now about how far back can you go?
That's been decided now. So in Neely, the court said, if you are timely, so in other words, putting aside whether we have a discovery rule, assuming a discovery rule applies, if you sue timely under that rule, you can go back as far as you are able to, you know, in order to get damages that would encompass beyond just that 3 year period that the Second Circuit and the Sohn.
I mean, so that's established, you think?
That is established as of Neely, yeah.
And the other issue is sort of the reverse is that, let's say you knew about the infringement, like Stairway to Heaven. No one doubted that.
Well, 1971, right?
Right. And but the court, the way that statute applied was they could only go back 3 years. So if the infringement is ongoing, you can go back 3 years, even if it started 40 years ago and you knew about it.
Right. And that's regardless, you know, whether or not the discovery rule survives, you will always be able to, in the cases of ongoing infringement, bring a timely claim. The question is, you know, are your damages, you know, going to be
generally
limited?
I mean, like an attorney and a transactional attorney negotiating this kind of thing is under the impression that you can only go back 3 years on damages. If you're trying to settle a case, and the major labels, I think, and publishers would tell you, and maybe they're wrong, but there
well,
is,
no, it's going to depend.
Like you can only go back 3 years on damages. Therefore, like you said, Peter, in the beginning earlier, that why would anybody sue if all the money was back, you know, 40 years ago or 30 years ago, and you can only go back 3 years? But it seems like this case, Neely, and maybe the next one is making it different. Like maybe you can go back 40 years on damages.
My point was different, that the Second Circuit in the case they had ruled that you can sue relying on delayed discovery, but you can't get any, you know, relief more than 3 years prior.
That was the Sohn v. Scholastic
case.
Right.
And so the Supreme Court said, no, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And putting aside for a minute whether discovery rule applies, we're going to assume it does. If you did have delayed discovery, you're not limited to a 3-year
period.
But
isn't that devastating potentially to labels and publishing companies that are defendants? If there's no limit on how far back you can go? I mean, is that fair?
But if it's open and notorious use, right? I mean, we're talking about a situation where you have to show that in the exercise of reasonable diligence, you couldn't have discovered this. And, you know, as Peter said, in this case, this guy was in prison.
But I'm talking about that's the discovery issue. Like I was able to bring my lawsuit and not get knocked out on statute of limitations. Now I can go back on damages 40 years or something?
Only if you can show in those jurisdictions that apply the discovery rule, which is more or less all
okay.
of you at this
well,
point.
I think it
you
know,
but,
makes...
but you have to, but you have to show that delayed discovery it was, you know, is warranted. You can't just assume that you're going to be able to go back 40 years. The default rule is that you're going to go back 3 years unless you can show that you didn't know about it and in the exercise of reasonable
okay.
diligence couldn't have known about it prior to bringing the lawsuit.
No, got it.
I just want to highlight one problem because I agree with you, Bill. It is tough to face liability going back 40 years, but in Petrella, what Justice Ginsburg said was that the passage of time doesn't matter because you just compare the works. And what that ignores is you have to show copying. So try litigating whether copying occurred 40 years ago. You know, and that's what Skidmore was. That, you know, we had this
that's
claim.
That's the Stairway to Heaven case, Skidmore.
Yeah, you know, that in 1971, a group cop had access to and copied someone else. So, you know, to try and deal... That's a horrendous burden to put on someone. It's one thing to say, and it's an appropriate thing to say that, look, the potential liability going back 40 years can be astronomical, but also just trying to, you know, grapple with the issue of copying, which is required in a copyright case, as to events that
Absolutely.
Happened in 1969. I mean,
you know, they were because that band Spirit was torrent was the opening act for Led Zeppelin and blah,
but
blah,
it
and
wasn't.
They claimed it.
See, that's one of the things. There's various misconceptions. What happened was Spirit was the opening band for, I think it was Deep Purple. And at the last minute, they tossed in Led Zeppelin because they were on their way to Washington. They performed, they left, they never talked to the group. They weren't there when they performed. And the group didn't play the song that was allegedly copied.
I got it. Ask you, Peter. Yeah, did you watch the recent documentary called
"Become"?
You've got to see it. It's wonderful.
Yeah, I hear it's great.
It's really wonderful. You are going to love it, and I'm sure those guys love you, Peter. because back then, it was commonplace for people to sort of borrow and stuff, just like you know, in the time of Shakespeare, people borrowed each other's stuff, and nobody made a big thing out of it until Blurred Lines came along. I mean, yes, there is a line that you can cross that you can't cross. Mm-hmm. But people, you know, it's part of the creative process. Everyone's standing on the shoulders of of giants, right? And that was Isaac Newton who said that, but then somebody pointed out, no, he stole that from a French cleric five centuries earlier. So, you know, it's no. How does the Copyright Act, you know, let's keep our eye on the North Star here, which is the Copyright Act is supposed to create a free flow of ideas and arts and things like that. You know, how is it helpful if somebody's using a descending bass line in an A minor chord and gets sued for infringement, which is what the Stairway was case was. Wow, okay. Well, do we have, unless there's anything else you guys want to mention on this one, we have time for one more. I have two more. Anything else you want to say on this? I'm sorry, Aaron, anything more on this? Okay. So would you guys want to talk about like walk-on music, which is, you know, politicians using music without necessarily having permission to walk out to the stage? Or do you want to talk about copyright terminations, Vedder v. Resnick? I'll bet you guys have picked the latter one. Because that's, let's take that one, yeah? Do you agree? Vedder?
It's so ridiculous.
Yeah, can we talk about that?
I defer to Aaron, whatever Aaron wants to talk about.
No, whatever you guys want. It's,
let's do that, Vedder.
But I agree with Peter. I think it is utterly ridiculous.
Can you tell us, Aaron, what that case is about, Vedder v. Resnick?
Yeah, I mean, this is a case out of the
and you've written about it in your great blog, by the way. I love that blog. It's copyright lately. So please, people check it out.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is kind of a wild case where there was a situation where a musician terminated under Section 304C, and his lawyer made what the lawyer conceded was a very novel argument that the termination not only effectuated a recapture of U.S. rights in the song, but foreign rights as well, notwithstanding that the statute specifically says it doesn't affect rights under foreign law. And the district court judge in Middle District of Louisiana found that claim was plausible. Now,
plausibility. Well, in Louisiana, they do things a little differently, okay?
Plausibility under, you know, the Supreme Court's, you know, Iqbal Twombly, that applies to factual allegations. It's not meant to be applied to novel legal theories, plausibility. And so you had a situation where the court said, okay, it's plausible, but then on summary judgment, without engaging in any real fresh analysis on it, said, well, for the reasons that I already held on the motion to dismiss, I'm going to find that it does effectuate a worldwide recapture. And the theory that was ultimately adopted, which is now going up to the Fifth Circuit, was that there is a single worldwide copyright, one copyright. And it is recognized by the source of origin of the work. So in essence, if you terminate a grant under U.S. law, it has a domino effect and affects everybody else. And it's a ridiculous thing because, of course, copyright exists independently in every territory in the world.
Well said. Now, this there's a lot of people who will be listening that are not copyright savvy. Either, and also non-attorneys, but what it is there's a termination right under U.S. law only. Pre-1978, there is a 56-year, after 56 years, there's a right of termination, 56 years after something was published, okay? And then for later works after 1978, they changed the law, and it's a 35 years after a contract was entered into, essentially, after there was a transfer of the copyright. And so what happens in renegotiations a lot of times is that people say, I'm going to serve you with termination notices unless you give me a better deal on old stuff. This is on old recordings. And the problem is that termination only takes effect in the U.S. So if you're going to a major label or a publisher, more likely publisher, and say, I'm going to terminate they'll say, okay, but we're still going to own it everywhere else except for the U.S. Why don't we renegotiate and do a better worldwide deal? So what this case would turn, if this case ever did hold up and went to the Supreme Court and held up, this would turn the whole business upside down, because it would be like, you can terminate for the world. All those negotiations would change. Everybody would try to get back their rights because it's worldwide, not just in the U.S. So, you know, you're saying, what you're saying is absolutely right. It doesn't make a lot of sense because of copy. There's not one world copyright, but the judge is saying, or the judge is agreeing with the argument that there's, it has to do copyright. This law has to do with the origin of the origin of the work, not where the infringement took place. There's a difference. Yeah. Anyway, what else can we say on that case? Is it just is there any chance that that's going to hold up, in your view?
Aaron, you want to, yeah. No. The answer is no. I mean, just to flesh out something, you know, Aaron said that the Copyright Act is clear that the termination doesn't apply outside the U.S. and there's actually a provision that says, you know, termination of a copyright has absolutely no effect on rights under foreign laws. And that gets back to Aaron's point, which is, this is what the judge said. And to give a little bit of background to that, the U.S. Copyright Act stops at the border. The, you know, Japanese Copyright Act stops at the border of Japan. We have a convention, the Berne Convention, that says that each country will accord to other members, authors, the same protection that that country provides to its own citizens. So you have basically different countries with different copyright laws that are saying, we'll provide that protection under our law to another member country's member of Berne, their authors. And so it's completely set up as recognizing separate copyrights in each country and according of protection to other member countries, to their authors. And so to say that there is a single copyright, it's somewhere in the ether, it's completely contrary to the Berne Convention.
Yeah, and other countries can, and some actually do, have their own reversionary schemes. And so, you know, under the UK has one. And so the idea, you know, that somehow the fact that this was created in the US as a work of US origin somehow then dictates what every other country is able to do with respect to its own internal laws is, in a word, nuts.
Yeah, and I would add to that, countries have different, sometimes it's the same, but they can have different protection. So until recently in the US, there was no public performance right of sound recordings, but there's always been a public performance right in the UK. Of sound recordings, you know, and that's what they chose. Now we have a public performance right for digital transmission of sound recordings, but that was a big difference between if you own sound recordings, that was a big difference between the US and the UK and other countries. And this idea that, well, no, there's a single copyright. What does that mean if the rights are different, depending on the country?
No, that's a great point. So you can't sue in the United States for a copyright infringement based on a sound recording that was made before 1972, like something like February of 1972 or something like that.
But you can't
sue for in the same way that you could for something that was after that.
Yeah, that's a good. Oh, sorry.
Yeah, I don't think you get a termination right, for example, on pre-72 recordings. Absolutely not. But you can sue for infringement. But for but in the UK or in France or Germany, you have at it, right?
Yeah.
And so that's a great point that you're making. So, but could somebody say, okay, well, I'm just going to sue in Germany then? But if it's a US recording anyway, that might not fly. But we'll see what happens. Lawyers are very crafty, aren't they? anything else on this, guys? We're pretty close to the end, and we've done an amazing survey of some great cases. And if not, I really want to thank you guys. Are great. This has been a wonderful conversation. Love to have you back again, because you know the news just keeps coming out with these more and more outrageous copyright, music copyright cases. So let's do it again, guys.